So I had something in mind to talk about today as a talk, but I'm also very aware that for America, it's a significant, for many people in America, a very significant day, being 6 months since September 11th. And I want to take a moment and see if does it seem appropriate for me to go on and give a talk about something which seems unrelated, or should we open up for a discussion and talk about? Would I like to talk? Go on. Well, I hope that out of our consciousness, I suppose what you mean is out of our Sangha, out of our community's consciousness, so that there's no way of us kind of talking about it together as a group, as a community. Is that what you mean, right? It's a kind of uncomfortable thing. A lot of people are dealing with it in their own way. Some people don't want to deal with it anymore, or just have enough of it, or would like this to be a place of refuge where they don't have to deal with those things because they deal with it everywhere else. And so some people, this is the place where, you know, they want to bring the deepest kind of concerns they have in their life and somehow address it in the Dharma. So there's a wide range of ways in which we are as a community. I don't know how to respond more than that. I mean, you brought it up just to kind of...
You brought it up.
I brought it up. And I hope it stays in everyone's consciousness and people have continued to have been changed for good, in a good way, by September 11th.
You addressed it relatively personally 6 months ago. I'd be real satisfied with just how you're dealing with it.
Well, that's a big topic, and it would take me a while to kind of be coherent in that way, to that would be respectful for everyone here to listen to what I have to say. But in very briefly, I think that for me personally, that as phenomenally tragic as September 11th was for America and for the world, and what's happened since then has been continued to be very painful for me personally to see what happens around the world in relationship to this. It wasn't a surprise. I mean, I feel like I live in a world where these things are all too common, and just the difference is that it kind of happened in, you know, in our own home, whereas usually it happens down the street or in town, next town over, you know, someplace else. But I've lived in enough countries growing up, and have been aware enough of what's going on in the world that, you know, even greater tragedies happen elsewhere. And I just assume that we live in a world where these things happen. So as tragic as it wasn't like this, you know, exactly a surprise or a shock or something new to process in some way that... So, I mean, I've been affected by it permanently, I think. It was a big impact on me, but it wasn't... This is, you know, I'm very aware this is the world we live in. It's a world of suffering and violence and love and beauty and all these things. But there's a tremendous amount of violence in our world. And to live blind to that, I think, just adds to the violence. Ignoring is a kind of a violent act in itself. So, a few words, that's myself. And, you know, I said this also back then. My motivation to be a Dharma teacher, to offer the Dharma and to people in the world, many years ago, was my personal way of responding to this kind of world that we live in, and in trying to make a difference. So I was already kind of pouring myself into that. September 11th couldn't change that because I don't have any more time to do more of that. But this is my personal response to this, that, you know, the suffering of the world, that even at that level. And sometimes people feel that, well, you know, what does this have to do with anywhere else? It seems to be kind of very personal. Some people say it's selfish what we do, sit here and meditate and other people are suffering. It can be very narcissistic, spiritual practice. And I think there's a fair amount of American Vipassana students who are narcissistic in the way they're involved in the Dharma. But there's not always such a clear line between being narcissistic in practice and just being healthily self-reflective or self-aware. And the language, a narcissistic person and a self-aware person can use the same language to talk about their experience. And it's very hard sometimes to see a difference. But I hope that, you know, it's not selfish what we do here, but it's really actually a very powerful contribution to the world. I said to people who went on retreat right after September 11th that I thought that was one of the most significant responses that they could have to that kind of experience, was to go into very deep, sincere spiritual practice. So I think that the world really needs people who learn how to take care of their own minds and hearts in a very deep way and don't perpetuate the ignorance and the greed, hate, and also are models to the other people in the world that it's possible to do a different way. It's possible not to live, motivated by greed, hate, delusion, fear, and those things. So I think it's very powerful. Just even though it's no overt way in which we'd be directly involved, in obvious ways, you know, we're not out there, not yet at least, you know, helping the homeless in Palo Alto. In Palo Alto, we are, some of us. But in Redwood City, or the homeless, or you know, so something. Was that coherent enough?
You talk about compassion in light of these events. How do we bring it forward, not just for the people who are victimized by these events, but for the people who perpetrated these events?
Why would you want to?
Pardon me?
Why would you want to? Why would you want to?
Because there's a part of me that recognizes that this is an expression of extreme suffering.
Isn't the compassion right there?
It's hard to reach.
You just told us you have it's there for you. You feel like it's kind of hidden a little bit for you? You feel it's hidden? Maybe it's less hidden than you realize. Maybe it's less hidden than you realize. And so that question was a beautiful question. And that probably comes from a compassionate place. And to recognize that. Sometimes we miss, you know, our good intentions or our good compassion because we think it's supposed to be more. We think it's supposed to be something else. And you're supposed to look like Mother Teresa or something. Or you're supposed to be infinitely forgiving or whatever. Compassion can be actually very simple. It doesn't mean we don't have mixed responses and feelings. But it can also mean that, that to be able to ask the kind of question you asked, I think comes from a place of compassion. And that's why I asked, you know, why were you asking? Because I just wanted to kind of mirror that it's already there rather than something you have to develop. Didn't hear anything, did you? Oh, we took the speakers away for you. We used to have them right on the floor so you could.
Can you want to switch places?
There's a speaker in the hall, in the social hall out there. So you can still sit in front of the speaker by sitting out there. Well, what I wanted to talk about today start off by telling you that that Buddhist practice is risky. And it would be nice if your spiritual practice was risk-free, and you can just come and just do it and get all these benefits. But there's actually risks involved with engaging in meditation practice, and certainly Buddhism as an ism, as a religion, as a spiritual tradition. And In the last few months, I've met several people who have been victims of Buddhism. Though that, maybe that's the way they word it. But I would suggest that it's not, Buddhism is actually very passive. It doesn't, you know, where is it? Like, it doesn't go around victimizing people. But it's the way in which we understand it, the way in which we engage in Buddhism, which sometimes can cause the person suffering, which is kind of sad, because the whole point of Buddhism is to help us not suffer. And some people suffer because of their encounter with Buddhism. And so one of the ways is that people have decided, so Buddha, you know, Buddhism is this, is one of the world's great religions. So it has a great authority in people's psyche. It's one of the great monolithic great religions of the world, and it must have, for people who are kind of inclined to look towards Buddhism for the truth. The authority of Buddhism suggests that, you know, it's the truth there. It's a great, you know, it's like God almost. Like, really, that's where the truth is. They have the right experience, they have the right understanding, they have the right truth, they have the right practice, they have the right whatever. And you look to there to get the right answers, to get the right way. And it's very, you know, because it seems like such a big authoritative thing, it seems like it's me against this great authority, Buddhism. And I, you know, who am I, puny little me, to have any understanding or to have any opinion that's different than what the Buddha had to say. And so people will go towards Buddhism looking for answers, looking for security, secure answers, looking to for experience or whatever. And what happens is many people then get alienated from themselves. They're looking outside of themselves, and sometimes they try to conform themselves to some ideal of what they're supposed to be like if they're a good Buddhist. Or they adopt a worldview, or they adopt certain teachings or understandings, not because they've thought them out carefully or it's their own deep understanding, because this is what the Buddhist texts and teachers say is true, and this, you know, that has to be the, you know, this, so I'll just adopt that for my own. And that's a kind of violence to oneself, to kind of just adopt blindly some teachings that you've read in a book. And then people have this idea sometimes that there's this great Buddhist experience they can have. And they read all these books looking for the right experience and looking how the right way to get there. And I've known some of these victims of Buddhism are people who've tried, you know, for years. They've read so many books and they've talked to so many teachers, listened to so many Dharma talks so intently and trying to, there must be some way of doing this. If I just listen carefully to the right teacher at the right time, they'll tell me exactly how to do it, and then I can apply myself and just really get it. And so they apply themselves to this thing, but they're always ignoring themselves. So always there's like this technique that's going to do it, that's going to save them, something outside of them. And some people think another way of being victimized by Buddhism is to think that Buddhism has this, it's like this magic. If you just put in enough time on the cushion, then something's going to happen to you, and you're right. You know, you put enough hours in, and it should be a fair exchange, right? If you give Buddhism, you know, 3,200 hours, then certainly Buddhism has to give you in return some, you know, great experience. Ajahn Sumedho says that if sitting a long time was the answer, then chickens would be enlightened.
How do we know they're not?
And Ken says, how do we know they're not? Have you been to a chicken yard recently?
I worry less than you do.
And it's a violent place. When I've told this story many times, but for those of you who haven't heard it, when I was new to practice, I was a Zen student, and I went to a little sitting group in the town of Davis. I was a college student. And there were four or five of us would sit in a little bedroom. In that tradition, we sat with our eyes open, and we sat facing a wall, and the bedroom was small, so the wall was right at my knees. And so I was facing this wall this far away. And I sat down one evening for the sitting group, sat there in good Zen posture, and this majestic Roman column arose in front of me, just appeared, manifested in front of me. And kind of like these solid columns that hold up banks and convince you that banks have, you know, a lot of authority and stability and you can really trust them and there's something there. Well, there's that kind of major column. And written down in kind of engraved black, kind of serious, authoritative letters was the letters Z-E-N. And I don't know, you know, I have no idea where the hallucination stopped and where reality came in. But what happened, what I know, what, I, you know, what happened next was that I went to embrace this column and the column vanished. And I fell forward and hit my head against the wall. And being kind of slow, you know, that kind of got my attention. And in reflecting on that, what I realized was that in being a gung-ho, you know, Zen student, I thought, you know, Buddhism and Zen was something external that I had to align myself with, I had to understand that, I had to study that. There was something to get in Zen. And what I learned then from that experience was that I had to, that really the idea was to turn the attention around and become aware of my own experience. Not what Zen is, but find out what Zen is through Gil, not find out who Gil is through Zen. And then I was very happy some time later to read the very famous quote by the Zen master Dogen that said, he said, to study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. And to forget the self is to be realized by all things. And but the beginning of that path is to you start by studying the self, study oneself. And then in studying oneself, in doing that, at some point, doing that well, they, he says, the self disappears, or you disappear. There's a forgetting of self. It's a forgetting of self-consciousness. And in doing that, then everything you encounter helps you realize who you are. You don't realize who you are by some kind of inner realization that you found my true self, but who you are, in a sense, is realized in the encounter with the world. It mutually arises. And I've known people who for years have applied themselves to Buddhist practice as a technique that in a way has taken them away from themselves. They're trying to get concentrated, trying to get calm, trying to get some kind of experience, and they're kind of experience chasers. And sometimes they have experiences in meditation. They feel very calm or very joyful or something nice happens to them. And they kind of hang on to it or they lean into it or they kind of savor it or let it soothe themselves or they kind of congratulate themselves, you know, this is it. And they don't, you know, they kind of rest on that good experience. One of the ways to do Buddhist practice and to study Buddhism is to study oneself. But is to understand Buddhist practice as always beginning with yourself. And it's a study of your own experience. What's happening to you? Your whatever experience you is. And it's not to get someplace, but rather it's to carefully get to know who you actually are, what's actually your experience is right now. So it's not a matter of then aligning yourself to a Buddhist experience. It's not a matter of attaining some Buddhist ideal or what the teacher wants or what you think you should supposed to be happening. But rather, it's to come back and really discover who you are. Who am I at this moment? What are my motivations? What are my intentions? What are my thoughts and feelings? What's my perceptions? What's the sense of self that's operating here? What's my relationship to the world around me and to other people? What is here? And to investigate that, get to know it. Without the idea that any of it is wrong or right. It just, let's investigate, let's find out what this experience is right now. And that's a very different process than sitting down and saying, you know, I'm going to do this great visualization, for example. In some sort of Buddhist traditions, they do very little time of being mindful of what's actually happening in the present moment. They do great visualization practices, they do great, do all kinds of things, but be in the present moment. And but one way of practicing Buddhism is to forget any attempt to get anywhere. Because any idea of the future of getting something keeps you alienated from yourself in some subtle way. or gross way. And be content to just begin discovering what's happening here. And to let the practice be a process of kind of self-discovery. And if you go talk to a teacher, you don't go to the teacher to get an answer. But you go to the teacher to tell the teacher, this is what I discovered when I paid attention. And the teacher says, great, that's fantastic. Come back tomorrow and tell me what you discovered tomorrow. Keep it up. You know, most of my job is to be a cheerleader. You know, great, keep it up. Come back tomorrow and tell me what you discovered tomorrow. It's going to be something else because things are always changing. And one of the things in Buddhism then, Buddhism is risky because Buddhism doesn't just simply leave it at that because the world of your own experience is really large. Then the Buddhist tradition actually suggests, you know, you should actually maybe limit it a little bit and really get to know what, not just you know all the external experiences of the world, and but actually why don't you find out what's going inside of your own psychophysical being. And why don't you open to that and explore that and get to know that really well. What is your own experience there? Now, this is beneficial because it's good to know oneself. It's really good. And if you know yourself really well, then you're less likely to cause yourself suffering. It's kind of a self-protection to know yourself because you know your motivations, you know the choices you make. And if you know them well enough, you can make different choices. You know which choices cause you suffering. But it comes from that familiarity of having really explored and discovered yourself. But there's another benefit to this kind of investigation, investigating what your experience is. And that is at some point, as you're doing this, investigating your experience, being in the present moment, investigating what it is, the power of investigation gets stronger. Your ability to investigate and observe what's happening becomes a stronger, it's like a muscle that gets developed. And that muscle investigation of awareness, of mindfulness gets stronger and stronger, is one of the great treasures we have about who we are. And it becomes a power that we can bring into the rest of our life, and it can bring a balance to our life, it can bring strength to our life, and that keeps us out of trouble, protects us. So for example, so many of us are preoccupied with our thoughts. And we believe our thoughts, we think their thoughts are the way we should understand our life. And we're preoccupied with the world out around us and everywhere. But if you identify more with the investigative function in your mind than you do with your thoughts, your beliefs, your identities, then that strong sense of investigation helps you not get caught by all those things in the world. And that strong ability to investigate gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and at some point it becomes like this great light. The ancient tradition talks about, you know, when the sun comes out, you don't see the light of the stars. It kind of, you know, drowns out even the moon to some degree. And when the light of investigation and mindfulness gets really, really strong, it overshadows or overpowers that of greed, hate, and delusion, and all the reactivity that we have. Not in a negative way, but a very positive way. So this thing about just investigating your own experience has this double function of greater familiarity and greater ability to make good choices, but also this discovering this whole other way of being, a strength that can then it keeps you from identifying so strongly. It gives you, this is not a good way of saying it, but it's kind of humorous, hopefully. It gives you the Teflon mind. You know, where you have this tremendously powerful, joyful or pleasant or vibrant, alive thing within you. Source of satisfaction, of contentment, of ease, of peace. That is so contented or peaceful that if someone calls you a dirty name, It's not going to ruffle that inner contentment. If you go out in the street today and find that someone's backed into your car and left, that inner contentment and peace isn't ruffled by such an unfortunate event. It becomes a resource, a refuge, a support in our life that's really helpful. So now I've said this. So I've offered you something very risky, because now you can say, oh, that's what I want. And I'm going to work for that. And then you're going to huff and puff and try. And it's a way of kind of getting away from yourself. Many of you are familiar with the famous discourse on the Buddha called the Kalama Sutta, where the Kalamas were a group of villagers who had a lot of religious teachers come through. And they all had different teachings. And when the Buddha came through, who was just one more religious teacher, they had the wisdom to say, hey, look, we get a lot of people coming through here saying we know what's true. And how are we to decide between all these different people? And the Buddha replied, it's good that you asked that. That's a good question. And he said, and then he gave them the answer. You know, but his answer was kind of, you know, was started off, the first part of it, as some people call the Great Manifesto kind of personal independence, you know, taking personal responsibility for your own life. It's don't believe that something is true, because that's what the tradition says, or because that's what your books say, your Bible say, your books, or because your teacher says it, or out of respect for your teacher, or because of your logic, you can reason your way through, and that's, you know, your reason tells you this is the way it should be. And it goes through a number of things. I don't remember all the categories. There's a lot of things. Don't rely on those things. But certainly, and then usually in English, the next thing people say is it says, rely on your own personal experience. But that's very naive to say that in America. Many people say that, you know, I'm going to trust my own experience. I can't really, I don't know who to believe, but I'll just rely on my own experience. And the extreme form of this, which bugs me actually, hopefully none of you say it, but is this is my truth. And you have your truth and I have my truth. That really bugs me. When people say that. And you know, my truth is it bugs me. And it might be your truth that you don't like it that I said that. Well, that's your truth. And you can have your truth and you gotta let me have my truth. This is kind of silly, but this idea, you know, this is my truth. It kind of makes us claim this is really true, my experience. There is something true about your experience, but it can be very naive, because what we have as our experience is often an interpretation through the filter of our biases and our preferences and our memories and, you know, our belief system and all kinds of things. So the famous thing I also said many times that I think is really cute. There was a psychologist or someone in New York 12, 15 years ago or so who was studying children who had near-death experiences. And as seems to be the case with human beings, that people who have near-death experiences often have very similar experiences. Tunnels of white light, you know, and moving through it, and sometimes they see some great religious figure. We've got a very similar kind of pattern. And some people have these, very transformative, very significant, these experiences where people have them. Maybe some of you have had them here in this room. And I don't want to I'm not belittling them at all, their importance. They're very important for the people who have them. But there's a way of saying, well, now I saw the Buddha. Now I really know the Buddha really exists, you know, the great Buddha in the sky. Because I saw it in my vision. And I was dying, you know, that's really. So they studied these children, and they found that for these children back in the 80s, there was a high proportion of them who, when they had the near-death experiences, they saw the Ninja Turtles. That was their truth. The psyche has this amazing ability to make meaning, symbolic meaning, to interpret things or try to make sense of things. Staying at a little hut in Thailand, and I took a nap in the afternoon, and I had this dream, I was climbing this little grass knoll, walking up it, and then I came to the crest of the knoll and stepped over the crest, down to the other side, the slope on the other side, and as I did that in the dream, I stepped on a stake, a very sharp stake that was sticking up out of the ground. And it was really painful to have this sharp stake going into my foot, my toe, or whatever it was. And I kind of woke up. I was still kind of, I realized I was dreaming, and I was kind of very conscious at this point, but still dreaming kind of. These dreams are really realistic. but it was so painful that I finally woke up. And what happened was it was an ant, these big Thai ants that had bitten in and holding on tight. My dreams, you know, needed to somehow interpret that experience in some way that made sense. My dreamer didn't know about the ant, so it kind of made do something with it that kind of made some sense out of it. And our psyche, you know, works that way. It's a meaning-making machine. So to say this is my truth or my experience without some sense of how our psyche reformulates things and changes things. Psychologists who study memory, for example, point out that memory is quite fluid. And we think our memories are true, this is the way it really happened. But actually, our memory changes over the decades and years, you know, and we understand a new way, we interpret a new way, and it can change. It's like the fish that gets bigger that you caught, right? And we see it in a large scale, in historic levels, where societies change their understanding of history, depending on what serves the current interests. And human beings are that way too. And so when you say it's my truth, to rely on my experience to find what's religiously true or spiritually true, needs to be done with some care. And so the Buddha didn't actually say, trust your own experience. What he said was, he said a number of things. One of the things he said was, it's good to get advice from people who are further along with you in the path. So he didn't say, don't just do it completely on your own. It's very hard to do it on your own. It's good to get some kind of guidance. But you have to be very careful with that guidance. And not be, one way of becoming a victim of Buddhism is to just give too much credence to these poor teachers who, are trying so hard, but can never do a good job. It's like one of the things, the teachings in Zen, which I studied first, which I always remember, is basically a Zen master, as they get older, they get longer and longer eyebrows. in Japan, the long eyebrows are the Pinocchio syndrome. The Pinocchio gets longer and longer nose is because every time he lies. Well, the Zen masters, they get longer and longer because they can never tell the truth. They can never actually say what's really true. So they keep trying. Or they try to, they're doing the best they can. And hopefully it's helpful. So he said it is helpful to kind of go and get talk to people who have more experience than you and get some guidance but he said the key thing was what you rely on is not what you really believe. Now I have a real understanding of something. But rather you rely on your ability to discern the difference between when you're suffering and when you're not. And that you can rely on. Hopefully you know when you're suffering. Well, sometimes it takes a while. We're kind of slow. But suffering, you can't argue. It's not a philosophical issue. Are you suffering? Suffering doesn't exist. Some people say, philosophers will say, suffering doesn't really exist. Some people say suffering sometimes exists and sometimes it doesn't. There's a whole but mostly, suffering, either we know we're suffering or not. We have suffering and we really know it. The Buddha said that ability to know that we're suffering is very, very key for following the spiritual path. And to know when we're not suffering, to know where happiness is. And that ability to differentiate between those two is something only you can do for yourself. And it requires mindfulness and attention to notice when you're suffering and when you're not. And then to notice those things that are conducive to greater suffering and those things which are conducive to being more free from suffering. And the way to follow the spiritual path, according to the Buddha, was not to adopt a worldview, a tenet of belief systems, or not to adopt some idea of some ideal experience that you're supposed to have so you can be sure you've done it right, but rather is to begin to find by trial and error that ability to negotiate between that which brings you suffering and that which brings you happiness or peace. And you see that for yourself, so you can start making wiser choices and follow the path that leads to freedom from suffering. And so when we rely on our experience in Buddhism, it's not to find the truth in terms of a philosophy, which many people want. The Buddha was not a philosopher. And even though some of his teachings can be kind of reformulated so they seem like philosophical truths, the Buddha, in my reading of it, was really trying to help people not suffer. In order to do that, we have to study ourselves if we want to take responsibility for that. And a big reason for doing mindfulness practice is so that we can find that place where we take responsibility for ourselves, for our own suffering, and for the release of it. And part of the reason we do concentration practice is so we can do the mindfulness with enough stillness of mind, stability of mind, so we can really see clearly what's happening. So, you might try it. When you sit down to meditate, to forget everything you've learned about Buddhism. Every idea you have about what the real meditation experience is supposed to be like. Forget about all the kind of great experiences you've had before, all the terrible experiences you had before in meditation, and see if it's possible to meet the next moment or that sitting completely fresh, as if, what is this experience? What is this experience? What really is it? And don't just settle for a simple answer. Don't ever settle for anything. That's part of the key to Buddhist practice, is you don't settle for anything. The expression in Buddhism is something like non-abiding nirvana, to attain the non-abiding liberation, the liberation that doesn't settle for anything, doesn't settle anywhere. So what it means is that you want to keep looking, keep investigating. What's this experience? I mean, look more carefully. Let's go carefully. You don't stop the investigation for anything. You have some great blissful experience. It's really easy to stop. I had a little bit of calm in my sitting here tonight. It was kind of nice and pleasant. And I noticed that I was a little bit mindful still, but I was kind of like, I was kind of a little bit sucked into enjoying that calm. And the idea is not to be sucked into enjoying the calm. The idea is to not settle anything and anywhere, but keep the investigation going. So on one hand, so that investigative power, that mindfulness gets stronger and stronger light and becomes in itself a great refuge. So the bumper sticker for Buddhists is, I don't stop for anything. Just keep investigating, keep looking. Don't settle for anything. And I think one of the... I'll give you my little personal philosophy. The saying that is a kind of disclaimer, so you don't have to believe it. But I think as soon as the human psyche has some understanding of what reality is or who yourself is or anything, you've defined it, you define something, and there's always something beyond whatever your definitions are. Because you can't really understand it completely. There's always something unknown beyond that. So, it doesn't make sense to settle for this understanding. I believe there's an innate kind of quest for a fuller understanding, unless we're afraid, or instead of holding on for something for security. So to settle in anything is to interrupt this natural interest to keep investigating, expanding it, and finding out more. So that hopefully, sooner or later, if you're a serious Buddhist practitioner, sooner or later you wake up from Buddhism. You go beyond Buddhism. You don't settle for that even. You're not even happy with that. Some people say you're supposed to get disenchanted with Buddhism. I think that's good. You are supposed to be disenchanted with Buddhism. As long as you're enchanted by it, you should get disenchanted. You have to. And any healthy Buddhist practice will have that kind of disenchantment. And it's very common for people for the first few years, perhaps, of a meditation, being involved with Buddhist practice, to have kind of a honeymoon period. it's really great, you know, you're doing this great world religion, and you're really cool, and this is exciting, and it's really wonderful, and there's kind of like this excitement of doing something new and powerful and wonderful and being involved with the truth, you know. And then after a while, it gets old. You know, it just doesn't work after a while. It doesn't hold up, especially if you keep being mindful, because mindfulness is self-correcting. You can't maintain that kind of attitude. And after a while, you're just like, what is this Buddhism? You know, it's like, you know, what is it? You know, and these people talk about it all the time, and you're just like, what's going on here? And it's like, it's boring. And one American Zen master said, if it's not boring, it's not Buddhism. And the reason for this is that, the saying this is that sooner or later, you can't rely on the sense of enthusiasm or confidence or comfort you get from this ism, this thing. That has to fall away, and you have to be left with yourself. Without any props, any support. Without settling on anything. And that's very frightening for some people. But by hanging out there and dealing with that fear and going beyond it, it's possible to find... Well, I shouldn't tell you what you can find, because then I'm offering you a carrot. And I was trying not to give any carrots tonight. Just be with your experience. That's really powerful to do that. And we give carrots so that you want to do that. But I shouldn't have to give a carrot. This is really significant. Am I making sense tonight? So I hope that, you know, if you're brand new to practice here, and I don't want to pull the rug from underneath your enchantment too quickly. But sooner or later, you know, you might get bored or disenchanted or by it. And it doesn't mean that you're supposed to run away and go Sufi dancing instead. What it means is that now it really starts. The honeymoon's over, and now you have to face who you really are. And unless you come to that point where now you really have to face the music, find out who you really are, and really see that clearly, you haven't really started the practice. So I hope I freed you all from Buddhism tonight. And at the same time inspired you to keep practicing. And make the practice your own. So if any of this tonight has been not useful for you, then you can leave it here in the hall. Don't take it home with you. You don't. So hopefully that was okay. And at your own risk, please continue.